If I mention the name Wadi Wachtel to you, there's a decent chance that you might not know who I'm talking about right away. But if you ever listen to a radio, or you own an album released between the late 1960s to about an hour ago, then trust me, you've definitely heard Wadi Wachtel play guitar. Wadi Wachtel has spent the last half century playing with and for some of the biggest names in music during an astonishing career where he's played with Bob Dylan, Keith Richards, the Everly Brothers, Bon Jovi, Elton John, Don Henley, Iggy Pop, Brian Wilson, Fleetwood Mac, Carole King, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Ronnie Wood, Joe Walsh, Ringo, Steve Perry, Brian Ferry, Melissa Etheridge, and about 9 million others. His resume is virtually endless, to the point where some of the finest musicians in the history of music have turned to Wadi to play on their albums, join them on tour, or produce their own records because he's somebody who they can trust and somebody that they can respect. He's just that good. Remember the opening guitar line to Edge of 17 by Stevie Nicks? That's Wadi Wachtel. Remember Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London? Wadi helped write that song. Ever listen to those early Linda Ronstadt records where she was still recording rock songs? Again, all Wadi Wachtel. Wadi has joined several legendary session players to form the band The Immediate Family, featuring Leland Sklar, Danny Korchmar, and Russ Kunkel, whose own resumes are every bit as staggering as Wadi's. The band has just released their second EP called Can't Stop Progress. This is a band that reads like a who's who of music, and so it's a real pleasure to talk to guitar legend Wadi Wachtel on Baxi's musical podcast.
What is it?
It's Baxi's musical podcast.
Resistance is useless.
Hey, Bax.
Hey, Wadi, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time today. I know you got to. It sounds like you're keeping yourself busy during this whole COVID thing.
We've been trying to. staying as active as we can for a band that hadn't seen each other for 6 months. We finally got together this week and are rehearsing now. It's so wonderful to be actually in the same room playing together.
It's funny. I'm going to be 55 this year, and I'm starting to now kind of like, you know, look towards the future, but when I can, you know, finally pull the plug on this sucker and, you know, march off happily into the sunset, you're going to turn 74 next year. And, you know, the guys in the band are, you know, about your age or, you know, damn well close to it. And yet the way you're talking, it's like you're just getting started.
That's exactly right. It really is. I mean, I'm going to be 74 next month, by the way.
Yeah, right.
we're a new band. You know, we're like the band we would have been when we were 20 if we knew each other. We just met and we had a lot of records to play on. So we, after 50 years of playing for everyone else, we realized the reality facing us was let's make this a band now. So, yeah, that's how we feel.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's a total amazing reality.
It is amazing because, I can't tell you how many times I can remember seeing you and Leland Sklar play on television with nearly everybody, whether it's, you know, Saturday Night Live or, you know, this show or that show. And then all the records I have in which you're given credit on the back cover, you just look at it and you just wonder, is it even legal to record music in California without one of you guys involved in it?
We've been very lucky, for sure, man.
It's an amazing career. I mean, to look at, because, you know, Leland's been doing this YouTube channel during the entire pandemic, and it's fascinating to watch him talk about all these songs that he played on and was a part of. But your career seems to almost parallel his in a lot of different ways.
It's close. I mean, I don't think there's too many more people that have been employed quite as much as Leland Sklar in my lifetime. Like I said, we've been very lucky and very blessed to do a lot of work. It's crazy when you think back to it and look back at it and all.
What's really interesting about music these days is that you don't see a lot of you don't see session work being done in the same way that it used to. I mean, now if you've got an artist that does 3 records in a decade, they're seen as, you know, being prolific and busybodies. But, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, it in order to have done everything you've done, you must have been doing several sessions in a week, several sessions in a day. It seemed, could you ever take a break back then?
Well, you know, the breaks we took were to go on the road with the artists we worked for. That was the only breaks we really took. I finally had a vacation when I was forced to take one by with Keith Richards when we were on the road, and he started talking about his place in Jamaica, and he says, I said, oh yeah, that sounds great. And I said, I've never had a vacation. He goes, what? I just never have. And he goes, you and your wife are going to my place in Jamaica. And I even fought it. You know, I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I can try to relax. I don't know how to do that. But I must say it was wonderful to actually get a week or 10 days of just laying around and then relaxing in this beautiful, beautiful place.
Was Keith with you for?
No. He sent us down. He had a staff at his house, and
because I can't imagine what 8 straight days with Keith Richards must be like.
It's you know, yes, you can. it's whatever, you know. It's like I've said to people when they ask me about Keith. I went, he is the guy you think he is.
Wow,
he really is. He's a beauty. He's the complete vision you have of him. He's a gentleman. He's a tough motherfucker. Oops, sorry.
Nice. You can say it. You can say motherfucker okay. as many times as you want, Waddy.
Oh, good. Well, he is both of those, and he's the sweetest and you know the most musical person in the world. But he's a very well-read man. Very literary and can talk your brain off for days. But he just is a music lover beyond, you know, above all.
Yeah.
And he's the guy you think he is. He really is. He fits that description. Whatever description you have of him, that's him.
It's funny when you talk about how musical he is. That's the same description that people have of you. And I've been watching all kinds of interviews with other people about you and you know, Stevie Nicks, for example. I watched an interview that you did, I don't know how long ago this was, with Dom Famularo, which was actually a really good interview, I thought.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. That was really fun. Dom's great.
I love watching Dom. He's not only a great drummer, but as far as an educator, he's fascinating to watch. But nevertheless, I mean, they're talking about you and about what you bring to the table when you're recording with somebody. And it sounds like you've been bestowed this amazing gift where your ears really do inform you about music. Like this, it triggers this curiosity. How can I learn this? How can I, you know, achieve that or replicate it? Is that something that you've always had, or is it something that, you know, took time to develop?
It was something I think I always had. I mean, I started learning songs when I was young, very young. I'd hear them and I'd learn. I used to walk around singing songs, you know, singing lyrics to songs. I was like a kid. I mean, even before I played guitar, I started playing guitar when I was 9 years old. But even before that, I thought everyone did the same. You know, when you're growing up, you think everybody's the same. You know, you think everyone's Jewish. You think everyone eats the same kind of food, likes the same kind of food. And everyone knows how to sing tunes and learn songs. And I realized, well, wait a minute, you know, that guy doesn't know that song. How come I know all these tunes? And then when I started to play, I would hear a song and I could take it from my ear and translate it to my hands. And so it started long ago. My ear has always been a real guiding force with me. And it even interfered a little with my learning how to read music, because when I would read something through, I would learn it. And then I wasn't reading it anymore. And my guitar teacher would say, you're not reading it. I said, yeah, but I know it. What do you want me to do? I can't unlearn it. Then I was always figuring out songs. When I'd hear a song, I'd have to learn it. I'd have to figure out what the chords were. And so, yeah, it's always been a thing for me.
So when you hear a piece of music now, are you able to pull it apart in such a way where it makes sense to you right away? Or are there moments where it really takes some serious hard work and study to get there?
Well, both. you know, sometimes, you know, I'll hear a song, I'll know exactly what the chords are, but sometimes it's like, all right, let me hear that part over and over and we figure out what's going on there. Sure, yeah, it's both, you know, because music is this evasive and elusive art form, so sometimes you think it's going to go somewhere, and because it doesn't, it makes it even better. So, yeah, it's a little of both.
So you started playing guitar, I think it was the age of 9, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And how soon did you start playing with other people in the form of a band? Was that like in high school, or when was that?
Yeah, I think, well, I was playing with a couple of guys. My brother, I have an older brother, Jimmy, and he had some friends who were like, quote-unquote, guitar players. A couple of years older than me.
Right.
So I'd play with these guys, and I realized, well, I'm better than these guys. These guys don't know anything. You know, at least I took some lessons, and, you know, I kind of knew what I was doing by the age of 14 and stuff. So by the age of 15, I was in, I think it was high school, we were just getting out of junior high, and I was approached by a friend of mine who's still a dear friend and said, you want to, you know, you're Wachtel, right? I went, yeah. He goes, you play guitar, don't you? I said, yes. He goes, you want to join a band? I went, yeah, sure. So, you know, we were playing in bands from, you know, age 15 till today.
And at what point did you say, okay, you know what, this is it. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Was that immediate, or did you, was there anything else that you might have done had you not picked up that guitar?
I've told this story before. No, I was, my mother died when I was 6 years old, but about a year before she died, we were standing in this house, and on television was a black and white TV, and there was a band playing, an orchestra. Well, not an orchestra, because there's no guitar, I learned, in an orchestra. That was a rude awakening when I tried to join the orchestra in the school, and they said, there's no guitar. I went, what kind of orchestra is this? But I was staring at this television, and all of a sudden they showed a guy playing a guitar, and I was hypnotized. I just stood there motionless, staring at this guy with this white, big jazz guitar, like a big old Gibson jazz guitar. And I was transfixed, and I just looked at my mother. I said, what is that? What is he holding? What is he doing? And she said, that's a guitar. And I went, that's what I want to do. You're 5 years old. What do you mean that's what you want to do? I said, that's it. That's what I want. So I was frozen by it. I was instantly addicted when I saw it being played. So yeah, that was it for me, and I knew that was what I was going to do. I didn't realize how fully I was going to do it, but I knew I had to play guitar.
There's a there was a great story you told with Dom Familaro about you meeting Leslie West for the first time, and I know he's a very close friend and died this year, but it's a pretty interesting story how you got to meet him.
Yeah, we were unknown to each other, living in the same apartment complex. And I was at home instead of being in school like I was supposed to be, usually. I was at home doing what I do, which is sit around learning songs, go outside, smoke a cigarette, come back in, learn some more songs, play guitar. And I went downstairs to get a pack of cigarettes from the local little store on the corner, and I heard guitar noise coming out of one of the apartments. I went, wait a minute, what? Somebody's playing guitar? So I went into, there was these two buildings facing each other. I went into his building, and I Columboed my way to the right apartment. I went to every floor, put my ear to each door until I found the one it was coming out of. And then I banged on the door, and this guy opens the door, and I said, hey, are you playing guitar? Are you the one playing guitar in there? He goes, yeah. I said, oh, cool. I said, well, my name is Bobby Wachtel, and I can help you. He says, you can? I said, yeah, I can tell you're just starting. You need help. I can help you. I play guitar. And that was the beginning of a lifelong, gorgeous friendship that sadly had to end this year. But, yeah, we spent – that was it. I mean, we just were glued to each other from then on in our buildings.
You spent a few years in New York after that trying to get your feet wet in music, and there weren't a whole lot of opportunities, or it sounded like there just, you know, there wasn't a whole lot for you to do. And is there a reason for that? I mean, I know you moved to California and all of a sudden you're playing with everybody, but in those years of New York, was there something different about the scene? Was there just nothing going on? How How do you explain
that? Yeah, well, no, there was stuff going on, but I lived in Queens. I was a shy kid. I didn't really, and I didn't know anything about how to get into these recording studios. I didn't know where they were. I didn't know anybody involved in them. And there was no way to break into it because I didn't know what it was I was supposed to be breaking into. I couldn't even imagine walking into a recording studio because I'd never been in one. I mean, I finally, with one of my bands, we finally did a demo and went into the studio for the first time, and I saw, you know, a recording studio. But I couldn't, there was no way I could get into the Atlantic Records recording studios or, you know, anywhere else. So I had no concept of how to do it. And fortunately, when we moved to California, it was a very open environment here. The timing of my move to this coast was incredibly important. And I think if I'd missed it by a month, maybe, and all of this wouldn't have happened.
There always seemed to be a very tight community in California, especially when you're talking like, you know, early to mid 70s, where, you know, all these artists are seeming to like almost cross-pollinate the way, you know, everyone is being shared. And, you know, you and Leland are, you know, playing for this guy and then playing for that lady the next thing. There just seemed to be a whole lot more sharing of people's talent in California.
Absolutely. It was a completely open, musically open invitation almost to get together with people. I don't even know how you would approach that now. But, you know, I was either in the studio or I was hanging with, say, J.D. Souther and I, we would be together, and David Crosby would show up at his house, or, you know, we'd be writing, Glenn Frey, and he'd call J.D., what are you guys doing? You know, Don and Glenn would come by Warren Zevon's sessions. When I was working on Excitable Boy record, and I got to that song, and I decided I wanted to hear the Beach Boy type of backgrounds on it. I called Linda Ronstadt. I said, hey, what are you doing? She goes, nothing. Why? I said, well, I'm down here with Warren, and I need to do some backgrounds, Beach Boy backgrounds. So she goes, why don't you call Jennifer Warren's? She goes, call Jennifer, and the two of us will come down. It was just like that. I mean, everybody was open and ready to help everybody else. It was an amazing community of music. That's how it was, and it stayed that way for years.
Do you remember what your first real big important session would have been?
Well, I mean, they were all important, you know, so it's hard to really say that. I mean, I came out, Bud Cowsill, the Cowsill's father, was our manager. And when Bill Cowsill left the Cowsills, I think that was the first session I actually did as a guitar player. He hired me, and I did that, and I met my dear friend Jim Keltner that day. Sneaky Pete, if you remember that name, Sneaky Pete was playing pedal steel on the date, but shortly after that, so that was my initial session. Shortly after that, I wound up working for a man named Nick Vinay, okay, who was a great producer. He produced Linda Ronstadt's Stone Ponies album, that first breakthrough album with a different drum. He produced the first Beach Boys album. Nick was a really important guy in this town. And I was brought to his attention by a friend of mine and played for him, and he really liked what I did. So I worked for him a lot, and I started working for other producers around town. But then one day Nick Vinay said, it's time for you to move on, which I thought he meant I was being fired. So I was really like, what's wrong? What'd I do? And he goes, no, you need to move on to other circles from this. So he had invited David Foster, was the new piano player in town. And he goes, so there's this new hot guy in town. I'm going to bring him down tomorrow night. I want him to hear you play electric and slide and everything. And so shortly after that, David liked what I did. And about a couple of days later, I got a call from Lou Adler. And that was entering the bigger circle at that time. That was the first big-time producer. And Lou had me coming. That's when I met. That's where actually the immediate family, the four of us, Steve Postel was still a baby at that point, but the four of us met. I knew Russell. I knew Leland. And I met Danny that day. And the four of us, so that was our first immediate family date was working for Tim Curry for Lou Adler. Peter Asher heard me playing with Carol and heard, you know, and so the word started going around from then on.
It seems to be the way it is with a lot of session guys. I did an interview last year with Kenny Aronoff, the drummer, and it was kind of like that. You know, once he started to get his feet cemented in what his sound was going to be like, and all of a sudden it was like, you know, one call after another. I heard you on this thing. I want to use you for this. And it's like,
yeah,
it sounds like that's what it is for a lot of session people, going all the way back to, you know, the Wrecking Crew and even, you know, beyond that, that, you know, once your reputation builds, I mean, you're kind of walking the path pretty hard.
Yeah, you are. It's a word of mouth situation that will spread very quickly. Thank goodness. That's how it was. I mean, it was doing a session or two a week to doing, like you said, working every day. We were doing three sessions a day for a while. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I'd see Russ Kunkel in the morning. I'd go do some other session in the afternoon. And then at night, we'd be working for someone else. That was a typical day, two to three sessions a day for weeks and weeks and weeks on end.
You mentioned Linda Ronstadt. I know you work with a lot of really great vocalists, and it's always, I don't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it always seems to me that, you know, singing is maybe the most challenging physically of maybe anything in music. I mean, if your drums go out of tune, you change the head and the snares. If your guitar goes out of tune, you tune the strings or replace them. But if your voice isn't ready at that point, it's like you give up for the day. You just keep on trying. It's like it's such a tender muscle to have it work the way you want, whether it's live or in a studio. And to be working with people like a Linda Ronstadt or a Steve Perry, who are just known to have just tremendous voices, it's got to be kind of something to watch them work and try to figure out how to get the most out of that talent.
You're absolutely right. I've always said to people that the hardest job in a band is the singer's job. And aside from the fact that your description is right about how tender that muscle is and how strong it needs to be, but another element of that is the breathing involved. You know, when you lead singer, if you're a lead singer in a band, you have to breathe so much to just do your job. You have to pull in that air and sing out a line and do it again. You know, when you're standing there playing guitar, you're breathing, but you're not, you know, belting out the air. It's very, very physically demanding.
Yeah.
Incredibly so. But you know, in the studio, it's unreal to, a lot of the sessions we were doing back then, they would have either the artist would do an informal version of the song, you know, not really belt it out.
Right.
Not really pour their heart. They used to call it a guide vocal. And sometimes it wouldn't even be the artist. It would be the songwriter or someone there just to sing the guide vocal. And then the artist would come in and sing their lead vocal. But with Linda, when I started working with Peter Asher, and Peter's theory was everything was live. So Linda's vocals were live, and it was astounding. I mean, the Blue Bayou record, that's her live vocal when we cut the track.
Wow.
And that's how it was done. So same with James. And another great illustration of that one was I just happened to stop by the studio on my way home one night at, you know, a million sessions. Stopped by, I used to call this one studio my favorite bar. I stopped by for a drink on the way home, and I walked in, and Val Garay was producing Kim Carnes, and he went, "Oh, Waddy, I'm so glad you're here." Josh Leo, who's a great guitar player and now is a great producer in Nashville, couldn't make this session. He was ill. He couldn't come to the studio, so I need you to play guitar. And I went, "Oh man, come on! I've been playing all day." He says, "No, please, please, you got to do this." And I said, "Okay, let me hear it." And the studio was full of people, keyboards, another guitar player, drums, percussionist, everything. And it was Betty Davis Eyes and Kim's vocal. Everything you hear on that record is the live take we did. There wasn't one overdub on that song. Everything went down live. And when we got done with it, as we were walking into the booth, I just grabbed Val and I went, I got to tell you, this is a smash. This is a fucking hit record, man. If I'm wrong, I'll be struck down by lightning. But if this ain't a fucking number one record, I'll be amazed.
You know, if you tell a story to someone who's young and new in the business and try to explain how something like that was recorded, and then to have that kind of success that that particular track had, you know, with all the auto-tune and the Pro Tools and all the computerization of recording, that must just seem like... It must seem like magic to them. Like they couldn't possibly understand what you're talking about to do it live with no real other enhancements, yeah, other than just, you know, simple basic production techniques. That's remarkable.
Right. Microphones.
Yeah, that's it.
Just with microphones and tape. Yeah. You know, I know it would be hard to, I would imagine it would be hard to fathom having grown up with like you said, auto-tune or having a keyboard in front of you that can do everything, you know, that can play drums, that can sound like strings, that can play piano, that can, you know, that can change the key for you. If you can't play in a key that has sharps and flats, you just transpose it to the key of C. It's very different. I mean, there are engineers, for example, there are engineers working today that have never mic'd a drum kit. You know what I mean? They panic. You know, real drums? What am I supposed to do with these things? You know, they don't know. It's crazy, yeah. It must seem very... It's kind of like a dial phone, you know what I mean? Having a dial phone. You know, you've seen those videos, right, of people, they hand them a dial phone, and they don't have no idea what to do with it.
There must be... And this is... The Kim Carnes example would be an example of this, but there must have been other times when you went into a studio... You know, with expectations that were not particularly high, and then when you finished that session, you were blown away. Do you remember something like that ever happening to you, where you just what wound up happening far exceeded what you were expecting?
Sure, it happens a lot. You know, thank God it happened a lot. I mean, it happened. Well, Blue Bayou is another example. There it was. It was done. I mean, the background vocals went on. Don Henley sang, and Kenny Edwards and Don Henley added their background vocals, but I mean, we came in and heard that incredible lead vocal of Linda's, you know, 2 seconds after we just played it. And same with a lot of her songs. But Poor Pitiful Me was the same way. That went down live. Everything on it you hear is live. My solo's live on it. It's very funny because there was a note in that solo that I wasn't crazy about, and so Peter Asher said, well, yeah, fine, let's replace it. So I went out to replace it. And he came out in the studio and sat down on the floor with his headphones on. It was really great. I went, what? He says, yeah, play. I'm just here. So I played another one I thought was better. And then looked at him, and he just went, eh. He goes, I like the other one. I said, fine, okay. Great. So it happens a lot. I mean, it thank God. That's really the magic, you know, first takes, we call them. When you nail it on a first take. For example, on Keith Richards' album, Talk is Cheap, the song, the first single, Take It So Hard, that's the first take. That was like, we couldn't believe it. Wow. That's it. The solo is live.
No wonder he let you stay at his place for 10 days.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's right.
When you're doing sessions and a record comes out and all of a sudden a tour is booked and you're ready to go out on the road, tell me what that's like. How do you prepare for like a long time out doing concerts? I mean, do you find that it is harder as you've gotten older, or is it just you know, part of the gig?
It's part of the gig, but it's funny, you know. We used to go out for months at a time. I mean, and so now it's not harder. It's still the same physical, you know, get the hell on the bus or get in the plane and check in the hotel. You know, you come to like, you know, I'm very used to that lifestyle. So my suitcase is still, we've been home for a year. My suitcase is still open, you know, with a few things in it, ready to pack it at any time. It sits in the closet, but it's open. You know, because, you know, you're ready to go in a heartbeat. But, you know, now you don't go out for months at a time. You go out for weeks at a time, if that.
Right.
So it's changed drastically. I mean, literally, we'd sit on that bus with Linda or James. We'd be on that bus for months, you know, two, 2 months, you know, we got an 8 week tour, and then you'd get out there, and then they'd say, "Oh, we just picked up a few more gigs. We're going to stretch it for another 2 weeks." You know, you'd be going for 10 weeks at a time. You know, 8, 10 weeks.
You hear on occasion about, you know, these artists will go out on tour, like Kiss is doing a final tour that's 2 years long. It's like the longest goodbye there's ever been. But yeah, I mean, I can't imagine being away from home, stuck with the same group of people for 2 freaking years. It's like, how do you do that without eventually wanting to rip each other's lungs out?
Well, you know, it's got to be the right group of people, or otherwise you do wind up ripping each other's lungs out. So it can get very bad. But if you got a great bunch of folks, and they all, you know, you all know what the gig is, so
yeah.
Everyone's just used to it, you know. That's what you do. It's just like any other gig, really, you know. But a little more travel involved, you know. You do a show, and you're back on that bus for like overnight, 10-hour drive somewhere, and get off the bus, get in a hotel for an hour, take a shower, get down to the hall, play a show, out you go.
I watched a couple of videos on YouTube this afternoon of the immediate family playing. And you guys, you're clearly enjoying, you know, playing, and you're clearly enjoying each other. Like, you have, you know, great respect and love for the guys you're playing with, and for good reason. But then all of a sudden I'm watching this video, and you know, suddenly, you know, Robert Plant pops out of nowhere, and he's singing with you, or it's Neil Young, or, you know, George Thorogood. I mean, do you have Robert Plant on speed dial and say, "Hey, Bobby, what are you doing? You want to come out and play?" It would take me 10 years to get Robert Plant to be on this podcast. It takes you 10 minutes to get him to play 3 songs on a show.
You know, I don't know him. What can I say?
Well, I do want to talk about the band, because, I mean, you do have some new stuff out, a new EP. And I think this is the second EP that you've released in the last, I don't know how long it's been between the first and the second, but it hasn't been all that long. I've noticed that a lot of people are releasing not full length records, but they're releasing, you know, the extended play, shorter format of things. It's
unusual to us, but that's what we're being asked. That's the way we're being asked to do it right now. It's new to us. I mean, EPs were like a thing that, you know, existed in the 60s and the 70s. It's like, you know, someone would put out a 3-song, 4-song EP. Because they were still working on their album, they couldn't get it out yet or something like that. But now it's, I don't know, that's just the way, you know, the whole structure of life has changed so much because of the internet. And that's the way people want it. They don't want to, I don't know, if they don't want to concentrate on a whole record.
Right.
Our situation was such, we had our first album, which will be coming out finally in August, was ready to come out in November. You know, it's been sitting there. So Can't Stop Progress is the first tune on the record. But we said, we got to put that song out. It's time. You know, it needs to come out. So that's why we built the EP around it.
Right.
But that's how it is these days. You know, it's alien to us, but whatever we're being told is the way it goes. You want to take advantage of the best marketing plan you can. So that's what we've been asked to do.
Were these songs recorded before the pandemic, or were you able to, you know, record them, you know, while the shutdown was going on?
Well, on the last EP, the one that had New York Minute on it, and Slippin' and Slidin' was done for our album. That Slippin' and Slidin' is on our album as well.
Right.
Progress, Slidin'. But New York Minute, that version, we did that pandemic style. Everybody did their own part at home. And then Steve Postel and I mixed it together. The rest of the songs were done prior to the pandemic, I would think. Yeah, that's the only... Easier, we started in the studio. That's a song that's coming out on the new one. We started that in the studio. We tracked it in the studio, but we finished it at home. I put the guitars on it with the vocal. We did the vocals at home and put the guitars on. So it's just been that way. I have a studio here in my house, and I've been doing work for people in out of my studio for years anyway. People would send you a file and say, "Here's the track, please play it, something on it." So I would do that. So been a lot of that going on. But that's been it, you know. That's pandemic style, is everybody one part at a time, send it to the next guy, put his part on.
That's how amazing. He did it.
Yeah, so New York Minute was strictly done that way. But I think I believe that's the only one. And the others, there's a couple of live tunes on the new one, really good takes of some great live stuff. And Easier is on it, a song called One More Time or Two of mine. That's another song that was, we tracked it in the studio, but we finished it at home. And Progress is the studio version.
When everything is cleared and it's time to go out on the road, do you guys expect to tour with this, or are you just?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We're dying to. We had, you know, like unlike not unlike everyone else, we were all set. Our year was all set to go. We had plans of touring. We had routed touring ready to go. Mm-hmm. We had the album coming out. We have the documentary that is being done about us. Everything was slated to go starting last November, and everything went goodbye. And so, yeah, we're itching to get out there and play. We want to play in front of people. That's the whole ticket. You know, with all the records we've made, you learn and you realize that the real thing is playing live. That's what records are, an emulation of live performance.
And it's, you know, to just release it and then to go back to sleep or go into hibernation, you never really get a sense of, you know, did I do good work here? You know, what's the reception of this? It's like,
yeah,
you wonder, because there are plenty of, you know, people that do just that. They don't play live or they just don't really want that connection, you know, with the audience. And I would think, you know, for a musician, that would be, that's your oxygen right there.
That is the whole, that's the impetus. That's the whole event right there. That's the idea, is getting those people to dig what you're doing and feel that energy coming back at you. That's what a ham bone artist is all about, getting on that stage, you know, getting those lights, getting that sound. There's nothing like the sound of guitars in an arena. You can't approximate what that feels and sounds like to a guitar player when you're standing on the stage at like the Forum or the Spectrum or Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
And you play a nice loud fucking note on your Les Paul and it just echoes in that room.
Well,
you can't capture that anywhere else, and you can't capture, you know, 20,000 people giving you their love and you giving them your love. It's that's the whole ticket.
Yeah.
That's the whole deal.
Well,
I was on the phone with Stevie Nicks last night, and the two of us are like going, can we get out there, please? You know, we've never been off the road this long.
I would think either one of you. It's been so disruptive, and it's, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate because, you know, obviously people would love to see their favorite music being played live, and I think what it just feels like we're so close to the end of this that once everything is reopened, people are going to go frickin' bananas when it comes to live performances and events and festivals and everything. I think everyone's looking forward to having it all back.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I just hope and pray that enough people will wake up and logically put their masks on and try to cool it so we can clear this out, you know, because I mean, you know, with Texas opening up wide open and other states opening up wide open, it's just an invitation to hell again. We're just never going to get out of this unless people, you know, wake the fuck up.
Got to take it seriously. Absolutely.
You know?
Well, yeah. Waddy, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Again, August is when you're expecting the album to be out. The EPs are available now. It's your career is legendary, and it's a real pleasure to talk to you and thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bex. I'm so glad to have the time to talk to you. It's my pleasure.
Well, it sounds like you got all the time in the world right now.
Oh yeah, wait a minute. What am I thinking? Yeah, that's right.
Waddy, thank you so much.
You take good care, my friend.
You too.
See you on the road, I hope.
I hope so. Again, the Immediate Family album comes out later this summer with Waddy Wachtel, Danny Karchmar, Leland Sklar, and Russ Kunkel. You can email me at bax@rock102.com. I'd love to know what you think of the podcast. Thanks for listening once again to Baxi's Musical Podcast.